Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Today, my colleague and co-host Sam Wong won't be with us. There are few issues that are as contentious as the situation in the Middle East, Israeli-Palestinian relations and relations between Israel and its neighboring countries. The failure of peace in this region and the ongoing violence that has been part of this multi-decade stories has been one of the most wrenching and difficult questions on the global stage. Many U.S. presidents certainly have attempted to offer or to guide various players to some kind of resolution. Recently, these tensions flared again in Gaza and surrounding the opening of the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, which culminated in a lot of controversy and deaths and injuries. Unfortunately, none of this was one episode. It's one of many episodes that we have seen over the decades where the problem seems to many increasingly difficult to solve. Is a two-state solution even possible anymore? Are feelings so hardened that there is no turning back? What are the implications of President Trump and his role in the region? Today, we have with us one of the more thoughtful commentators on the situation to discuss his new book, Yossi Klein Halevi, who is the author of a new book, Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, which was published by Harper. He is a senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. He co-directs the Institute's Muslim Leadership Initiative. And he's the author of several other books, including Like Dreamers, the story of the Israeli paratroopers who reunited Jerusalem and divided a nation, which came out a few years ago to really fantastic reviews. And it won the Jewish Book Council's Everett Family Foundation, a Jewish Book of the Year Award. He also writes op-eds for many leading newspapers. He also authored another book, At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden. And he's become an important voice on this issue. So we're delighted to have him today to discuss his book, Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor. Welcome to our show.
Thank you, Julian. Good to be with you.
Thank you. So the release of your book comes right around the time of another major flare-up. And I guess before we get into the book, maybe we could just hear your thoughts on the situation with the embassy, the situation in Gaza, and where we are today.
It's really hard to know where to start, and we're at really one of the lowest points in the pathological entwinement of these two peoples, the Israelis and the Palestinians. And at this point, if you were to just freeze the frame to this moment, you know, when you asked the question a moment ago, is a two-state solution even possible, the answer would have to be no. A two-state solution has now, for a long time, has been not just elusive, but really a fantasy. And the question is a two-state solution permanently over? Or is there still a possibility down the road of reviving what I believe is the only workable alternative? And it isn't a good alternative. A two-state solution hasn't worked in part because neither side really wants it. A two-state solution means that each side has to sacrifice a piece of this little tortured land that we share and which both sides believe deeply belong to them. And each side, from its own perspective, its own narrative, can make a compelling claim for why the totality of that little land from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea belongs to them. And so the question really is, do we freeze the frame now and just say, that's it, it's over, we tried, and then what? You know, then do we descend into a one-state nightmare, which will resemble Yugoslavia at its best? Or do we say, you know, from the very beginning of this conflict, predating the creation of Israel, the only workable plan that was on the table was partition, dividing the land. And so this, you know, I in the 1990s, during the Oslo years, I was an Oslo skeptic. I didn't believe it was going to work. I didn't believe that it was going to lead to an agreement. Now that everyone seems to be despairing of a two-state solution, you know, maybe I'm just a curmudgeon, but this is the moment where I feel we have to reaffirm the international community. The two sides need, or majority on both sides need, to reaffirm a commitment to the only alternative to an even worse catastrophe.
So you've written a lot about both the best possible alternative and the difficulties with that. It's an alternative, meaning the two-state solution that neither side is particularly eager to have, and about the increasing difficulty of even seeing that path forward. And you decided now to tackle this through a book in the form of a series of letters. And maybe you can start by telling us a little bit about how you thought of the project and how you thought about tackling the issue this way.
Well, to some extent, the book is a result of insomnia. I live in a neighborhood in Jerusalem called French Hill, which is the very edge of Jerusalem, and I live in an apartment that is in the last row of houses in French Hill, and which is another way of saying that I live at the very edge of Jerusalem. Beyond my porch is the West Bank, and the wall, what Israelis call the security barrier, the separation wall, as Palestinians call it, between the state of Israel and the West Bank. And on the next hill, right across from my porch, are Palestinian villages. And when I can't sleep, I pace and I look out at this beautiful, complicated, painful view. And at some point, I started composing letters in my head to a Palestinian neighbor on the next hill whom I don't yet know, trying to explain who I am, why I live in Israel. I grew up in New York. Why did I move to Israel in 1982? Why did the Jewish people come home in our terminology? Who are we? What's our story? How did we maintain a kind of vicarious indigenousness with this lost homeland that we never actually relinquished? And so I started speaking to this neighbor, and one night I started writing. And in a sense, this book is a sequel, a belated sequel to an earlier book that you mentioned, called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, which has not only the longest title but the longest subtitle, which is A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. And that was a journey that I took in the late 1990s, when it was increasingly clear to me that the Oslo process was failing. And I felt that as a religious Jew living in this sacred, complicated land, there needed to be some effort made by religious people to create a religious framework, a language of devotion that could help us lead us to reconciliation. And so I went on a year-long journey into Palestinian society. I went into mosques and churches. I was privileged to be admitted on a number of occasions into the Muslim prayer line. And that was a very powerful experience. I immersed myself in the Palestinian narrative. I read Palestinian histories, personal accounts, poetry. I listened to people's stories, and I tried to see this conflict through Palestinian eyes. And the book was published, the pub date was September 11th, 2001, which will give you some indication of, right, of the fate of that book. The book really disappeared, and I lost my connection with the book. Meanwhile, the Second Intifada was happening in Israel. The Second Intifada is the what we call the 4 years of suicide bombings in Israel. And that was a really traumatic moment for most Israelis. The Israeli left practically collapsed during the Second Intifada. And I went into a kind of despair, as I think most Israelis and Palestinians did. But what woke me from that kind of prolonged state of frozenness was an email that I got a couple of years after my book came out from someone named Abdullah Antepli, who I did not then know. And he introduced himself as a Turkish-born imam who was at that time the Muslim chaplain at Wesleyan. And he said that he read my book, and you know the writer's joke, you're the one, right? Well, it wasn't that far from the truth here. And he said that he was deeply moved by the love for Islam that I expressed in the book, and I really did learn to fall in love with Islam as the power of Muslim prayer, the power of the prayer line. It was an extraordinary experience, and you know, when you sit in a pew in a Western style prayer service, it just doesn't have that power, that tactile power that Muslim prayer has. And so I wrote about that in the book, and Abdullah wrote me saying that he would like to reciprocate my journey into Islam with a parallel journey into Judaism. And we stayed friends, and we really deepened our friendship. And then about 10 years later, Abdullah said to me, I want to start a program teaching Judaism, Israel, Jewish peoplehood, Jewish contemporary Jewish identity to emerging Muslim American leaders. Not to convince them that Israel is right about anything, just to help them understand how Jews understand themselves and why Israel is not just a political issue for so many Jews, but a core identity, a core part of our identity. And so at that, I had just recently joined the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, which is the preeminent center for interfaith work in Israel and also intrafaith Jewish work, the interdenominational Jewish work. Mm-hmm. And so we set up a program called the Muslim Leadership Initiative. And for the last 6 years, I've been teaching Muslim American leaders about who the Jews are. And partly as a result of that experience and as a result of the pushback that I've gotten over these years and about the occupation, about those parts of Israeli life that many of us in Israel didn't want to look at anymore because of the trauma of the Second Intifada, because of the constant attacks against Israel. We went into this kind of siege mentality. And my friends in this program really forced me out of that siege mentality and said, you need to start looking again at your neighbors. And so what I've tried to do in this book is really the next stage of what I tried to do in my previous book, which is there I really tried to listen to Palestinians and understand their story, and here I'm asking them to listen to my story.
And when you imagined who you were writing the letter to, did you imagine someone in particular, or was it just imagining a Palestinian who was living in your, you know, eyesight?
I had a few people in mind, and I went through a few drafts of this that were addressed to a Palestinian journalist who I had been friendly with before the Second Intifada. And in the end, I decided to write this book to an anonymous Palestinian for two reasons. One is that I felt that if I were to write to a Palestinian, I would be in some sense pretending that the situation was better than it was. And by writing to an anonymous Palestinian over this wall that divides us, and And in my case, looking out at the landscape, it is, as I say, a physical wall, but it's also obviously a metaphorical wall. And to be writing to a Palestinian whom I don't yet know felt more truthful to this moment, mm-hmm. where relations between Israelis and Palestinians are increasingly rare. Even among Israelis like myself, who had spent considerable time in Palestinian society in the 1990s, the year 2000, the collapse of the peace process, the beginning of the Second Intifada, and all that's happened since has made connections between Israelis and Palestinians very right. rare. And so I felt that this approach was more resonant with the reality today. The other reason that I decided in the end to write this in this way is because I feel deeply that one of the main obstacles to peace is the rejection within not only Palestinian society but within the Arab world of Israel's indigenousness, of the Jewish people's link, rootedness to the land that we share with the Palestinian people. And that 70 years of rejection of the Jewish story, of the Jewish connection to this land, has resulted in a disastrous hardening of Israeli political attitudes. The main beneficiary of the Arab world's rejection of Israel's legitimacy is the Israeli right, is the settlement movement. Because what your average Israeli says is, look what they write about us in the Palestinian media. There never was a Jewish presence in this land. It's all a Zionist myth. There never was an ancient presence here. There never was a temple on the Temple Mount. The Holocaust is another Zionist myth. That's normative in right. all parts of the Palestinian media, not only Hamas, in the Palestinian Authority media as well. And the devastating psychological and political consequences on the Israeli public is cumulative, because year after year, the all that Israelis hear from most of the Arab world, and certainly from Palestinian society, is you have no right to exist. And so your average Israeli says, well, what will happen the day after we withdraw from the West Bank? Will there be peace? And you know, if you follow Israeli polls, there's this really interesting pattern. Ask the Israeli public, do you support a two-state solution? A majority will say yes. Mm-hmm. Ask the same people, do you think a two-state solution will bring peace, or will it only lead to greater conflict? An even larger majority will say it will lead to greater conflict. So what those polls say to me is that a majority of Israelis in principle want a two-state solution, in practice are terrified of the consequences of a two-state solution. And so what I'm hoping with this book, and this is obviously a very modest way, I'm a writer, I'm not a politician, is to try to model some kind of a new conversation between Israelis and Palestinians, where we begin taking each other's narratives seriously without agreeing with each other's narratives, and we won't. But at the very least, acknowledging that this isn't only that the challenge isn't only to achieve a two-state solution; it's to do so while respecting or accommodating a two-narrative conflict, a two-narrative problem.
Well, you had a line that I caught when you write, one of the main obstacles to peace is an inability to hear the other side's story. For peace to succeed in the Middle East, you say, it must speak in some ways to our hearts. And what you're discussing is interesting, that a lot of people think of the conflict as a continuum. They'll talk about the Intifada in the late 1980s and the second Intifada and everything going on today. But you're noting there has been a significant change. And even though the two populations live in incredibly close proximity, people who haven't been there, I don't think, realize just how close the two populations are. but there's a kind of hardening of interaction. There's not the same kind of fluidity you still saw really in the 1980s and 1990s.
Exactly.
And that has changed the way both sides perceive each other, but also perceive the basic story of the conflict.
Which is exactly why it felt false to me to try to write to a particular Palestinian. The very act of writing to a Palestinian who is anonymous, just as I'm anonymous to my neighbor, really expresses the moment we're in. You know, when you talk about the let's say the intimacy of geography there, it's hard to convey to outsiders just how small and cramped the country feels to both peoples. From my porch, I can look out and clearly see three distinct political entities. The state of Israel ends outside my porch, literally on the road outside my porch, the sovereign state of Israel. The West Bank begins on the other side of the road, and I can see the Palestinian Authority in the distance. And then in the farthest distance, clearly visible at night, are the lights of the Kingdom of Jordan. And that's all within an hour's drive. Mm. And so when you think about these two peoples living in such tortured proximity to each other, I write in the book at one point that I feel that we can hear each other breathing. And that really occurred to me late one night. I was sitting in my office, which is right adjacent to my porch, and looking out and hearing the muezzin, you know, the call to prayer at 4 in the morning. And it was one of those sleepless nights, and I felt, you know, we can hear each other praying, and there's no greater intimacy than that. Certainly for religious people, and you know, many Israelis hear the muezzin as a kind of threat, and try to block it out. I listen to the muezzin and I feel uplift. I feel, wow, this is, you know, how amazing, what a privilege it is to live in a land where there's a call to prayer 5 times a day, where somebody is actually taking the trouble to remind people that don't just be a sleepwalker through your life. Pay attention, and pay attention to the quality of your devotional life. And so for me as a religious Jew, hearing the muezzin, the Muslim call to prayer, is a gift. But that same call to prayer can be heard by an Israeli as a threat. And that's an expression of how this intimacy can really go both ways. You can either be uplifted and hopeful about living in such close proximity with the other, or you can see this as an existential threat.
And you write, picking up on this in one of the passages of the book, we are trapped, you and I, in a seemingly hopeless cycle, not a cycle of violence, a lazy formulation that tells us nothing about why our conflict exists, let alone how to end it. Instead, we're trapped in what may be called a cycle of denial. Your side denies my people's legitimacy by my right to self-determination, and my side prevents your people from achieving national sovereignty. The cycle of denial defines our shared existence, an impossible intimacy of violence, suppression, rage, and despair. That is the cycle we can only break together. The obvious question is, you are putting forth an effort to break that through your writing. But is it realistic that this generation, both of Israelis and Palestinians, can move in a different direction? How does that actually happen in practice?
Well, first of all, those lines that you read are the heart of the book. If I had to just choose one paragraph that tries to sum up what I was hoping to do in this book, it's that. And in terms of how realistic it is, again, you know, if you just freeze the frame to this moment, It's impossible. We've never been farther apart. Our minimal requirements can't be met by the Palestinians, and the same is true in the other direction. But if you widen the lens and you look at what's happening in the Middle East, there are some very tantalizing possibilities from an Israeli perspective, which could also have an impact on the Palestinian tragedy, and that is that the shared fear of an imperial Iran is bringing together Israel and much of the Sunni world. We now have a, for all practical purposes, a strategic relationship with the Saudis, which was inconceivable 2 years ago. Saudi Arabia was the most implacable enemy of Israel in the Arab world. The Saudi media was probably the most consistently anti-Semitic in the world. Today, the Saudi media is publishing op-eds denouncing anti-Semitism and interviewing Israeli leaders. And so, because this is the Middle East, rapprochement tends to happen more through shared fear than through a vision of what Shimon Peres, the late Israeli leader, used to call the new Middle East, a new Middle East that would be brought into existence through shared economic cooperation. There may ultimately be shared economic cooperation, but in all likelihood it will come through shared military cooperation. Now, the question is, how far will this new security relationship go, and can it be transformed into a political relationship? I don't believe that Israeli and Palestinian leaders anytime soon can negotiate an agreement, certainly not a final status agreement. I doubt whether we can even negotiate an interim agreement. But if you bring in the Arab world, then the concessions that Israel can hope to receive in exchange for starting to wind the occupation down, starting to contract, starting to freeze settlement building, starting to think about what areas will it begin to withdraw from. And it will be a very gradual process because of the extremely delicate security issues. But to start reversing the momentum that we're in now toward more and more settlement expansion, and that can be done together with Arab countries who have a lot to offer Israel. They can offer us gradual normalization. They can offer us concessions that the Palestinians can't or won't. And so my hope is, and admittedly it's a slender hope, but it is nevertheless a slender hope that I did not have 2 years ago. That is that a changing Middle East might create openings where we can begin to think beyond the stuck track of Palestinian-Israeli negotiations, and to widen the process and see what happens.
You're saying that in some ways, because of the changing politics in the Middle East with countries such as Saudi Arabia, as well as, you know, more economic ties between Israel and some other countries outside the Middle East, there is a possibility, maybe a slim possibility, that those changing relationships, that normalization of Israel in the international community in places that have been hostile to it, might create some opening for the other story, which is of a kind of hardening divide between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Look, one of the ways that if you look at the pattern of when Israel is flexible toward its neighbors and when Israel hardens, you see that there's a profound influence on Israeli attitudes, depending on Israel's place in the region and in the world. So, for example, in 1975, when the UN voted, the UN General Assembly voted to declare Zionism a form of racism, the Israeli public pushed back, by endorsing the settlement movement. Until that moment, the settlement movement had not succeeded in breaking through into mainstream support. And that was the moment when would-be settlers who were squatting in the West Bank and were repeatedly being evicted by the army. This was the time of the labor government. That was the moment when there was such strong outrage on the part of Israelis against the UN that much of the public embraced the settlers. And that was the breakthrough moment for the settlement movement. And it happened at a very specific time. It happened 3 weeks after the UN Zionism Racism Resolution in November 1975. And 2 years later, Anwar Sadat steps off a plane at Ben Gurion Airport. And Sadat, who until that moment had been one of the most hated men in Israel, because he had launched a surprise attack on Israel on Yom Kippur 1973, and 3,000 Israeli soldiers were killed in that war. Sadat steps off the plane, and thousands of Israelis line the streets to cheer him as a hero. And then when the Israeli government was hesitant about withdrawing from all of the Sinai Desert, the public pressured the government into a total withdrawal, because they felt here was the first opportunity that we've had for acceptance, genuine acceptance, in at least part of the Arab world. That pattern has continued. The Oslo process began after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which had been the greatest enemy of Israel in the international scene and certainly in international forums. And literally several dozen countries, both in Eastern Europe, in Africa, Asia, recognized Israel in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. And that had a tremendous impact on the Israeli public. Yitzhak Rabin was elected prime minister in 1992, and in his inaugural speech in the Knesset, he told the Israeli public that it's time for us to give up the notion that the whole world is against us. That's an old Israeli phrase. Mm-hmm. And to look at a changing reality where Israel is becoming a part of the international community. That set the stage for a majority Israeli support for the Oslo process, which began a year later. And then when the Second Intifada happened, and Israelis felt, well, wait a minute, we had just offered, first at Camp David in July 2000, and then in December 2000, when President Clinton laid out his proposals for ending the conflict, Israelis said, well, we just accepted two plans for ending the occupation, for a two-state solution. And what we're getting in return is the worst wave of terrorism in our history, and the international community is still condemning us for an occupation which we just tried to end, and as if nothing had changed. The public hardened and turned right. And so what we're seeing playing out in these last years of an increasing right-wing turn in the Israeli public is due to no small extent to Israeli perceptions of being unfairly treated by the international community. That's one reason why I think the new change in tone mm-hmm. coming from the Saudis and the Gulf states is so crucial, and why I'm so desperate for Israelis to be paying attention to this. What worries me about Israeli society today is that we've become so cynical, so hardened, so understandably wary of being deceived by a false peace process, as so many Israelis concluded we were during the Oslo years, that I worry that Israelis may not be paying close enough attention to the changes that are happening in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this should be front page news in Israel. Every time there's an editorial in a Saudi newspaper calling for for accepting Israel as part of the region. I mean, that should be on the front pages of the Israeli media. And so I worry that we may be missing something that's unprecedented.
I want to read one more passage from your book, from one of the letters. And here, I believe you're talking about the 48 war. Still, by the end of the war, it was your society that was shattered. Israel destroyed over 400 emptied Palestinian villages, and Jewish refugees, many from Arab countries, were resettled on many of those sites. Palestinian refugees were dispersed in Syria and Lebanon and Jordan, in the Jordanian-held West Bank and the Egyptian-held Gaza Strip. As we Israelis celebrated our reclaimed sovereignty and achieved one success after another, your people exchanged homes and olive orchards for the scorched earth of refugee camps, where you raised children without hope, the unwanted outcasts of the Arab world. I mourn the lives wasted in the bitterness of exile, your despair against my joy, but I cannot apologize for surviving. What almost any Israeli Jew will tell you is that if the Palestinian and Arab leadership had accepted compromise instead of declaring a war to the death, the Palestinian tragedy would not have happened. And what I'm curious about after our conversation, do you ever, I think a lot of the fears within Israel, from what I'm hearing and from my perspectives, have been really driven by fears of security, by fears of stability and hostile adversaries. Do you worry that that could turn? And it's less about survival and it's less about stability and security, that the tension from Israelis to the Palestinians actually turns into something different. It's about the Palestinians. Yeah. How do you see that? Is that kind of hatred becoming stronger?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the things that keeps me up at night. And it's part of a wider threat to Israeli democracy. The attitudes are hardening, and the longer the war goes on and the more that one generation after another grows up convinced that there's no chance for any way out of this, the more that attitudes begin to shift. And again, the primary beneficiary here is the right, and even the hard right. And, you know, my generation, I was a graduate of the First Intifada. The First Intifada was the Palestinian uprising in the late 1980s, and I was drafted into the IDF at the height of the First Intifada, and I served in the Gaza refugee camps. And my generation, or much of my generation of Israelis, came out of that experience convinced that this isn't working, and we need to find a different way. And the election of Yitzhak Rabin in 1992 was in large part a response to that awakening in a large part of the Israeli public. And, you know, if the settlement movement and the dream of a complete land of Israel from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea led to the First Intifada, then let's see what... Let's try the position of peace now. Let's try the position of the left. And the perception in Israel, I would say the normative perception, is that was also a dead end, and that dead end literally blew up in our faces during the second Intifada of the early 2000s. Now, what's happened is that the generation that's grown up since the collapse of the Oslo process sees itself as living after the peace, after we had tried peace, after we'd given peace a chance, and then it failed, and most Israelis will tell you it wasn't our fault. Whether one agrees or disagrees with that narrative, you can't understand Israeli politics and society today without understanding how deeply that narrative is held by a strong majority of Israelis, that we tried to make peace, and those overtures were rejected because the conflict ultimately is not about the consequences for 1967, about the future of the West Bank and Gaza, but about 1948, about the existence of Israel. And so that attitude, which in my generation, you know, because we were the generation that experienced the First Intifada, that understood that this is a complicated conflict, and we bear our share of responsibility for the conflict. So my generation was able to, in a way, process the Second Intifada without shifting right. But our kids' generation didn't have that nuance, didn't have that experience. All they have is the memory of failed Israeli attempts to make peace and terrorism and rockets from the north, rockets from the south, now Iran in Syria. And when you grow up feeling that your side tried to make peace and that the other side is committed to your destruction, then politically you don't really have anywhere to go except right or further right. And so that's what worries me. And when you ask about hatred, yeah, mm-hmm. I think there's a lot more hatred in both societies. And the younger you go, the more hatred you experience.
Yeah, and I think some of that is going on in the American Jewish community as well. My guess is you have a similar dynamic even here.
Yeah, I think the American Jewish community is in a different place than Israel is, because what I find still true in Israel is that a majority of Israelis are not left or right, but centrist. Now, again, that's not necessarily true when you go younger. When you go younger, it becomes more right. But as a whole, the polls still show that a majority of Israelis want a two-state solution on the one hand, which is the left-wing side of a centrist persona, but don't believe that a two-state solution would bring peace anytime soon, and that's the right-wing side of a centrist worldview. Now, in the American Jewish community, I find that nuance often lacking, and I often feel when I come back here to speak in the Jewish community that I'm in a kind of a time warp. When I speak to Orthodox Jews, right-wing Jews, it's the 1980s, and Menachem Begin is still prime minister, and the First Intifada hasn't happened. And all we have to do is just continue building the settlements and maintain what's ours. And then when I speak in liberal Jewish communities, it's the 1990s. And the Second Intifada hasn't happened yet, and it's the good old days of Oslo. And all we have to do is just sign the damn deal, because we all know what the deal is going to be like. And again, that's as if the Second Intifada never happened. And most Israelis live, I believe, somewhere in that meeting point between the left-wing realization that so many of us came to as a result of the First Intifada and the right-wing realization of the Second Intifada. And Israeli society is to a large extent stalemated against itself. And many of us have internalized the left-right debate so that it's not happening just out there between two rival camps, but it's happening inside of each of us. And there's that constant argument that I have with myself of which scenario is worse? Which is your greater nightmare? Is it withdrawing from the West Bank and risking a Hamas-run state 5 minutes from Jerusalem and Tel Aviv? That's one nightmare. Or is not withdrawing and having another 50 years of Israel ruling over a neighboring people with all of the moral and political and strategic consequences of that pathological situation? Which is the worst scenario for Israel? I often say that, you know, I live with two nightmares. Mm. The first nightmare is that there won't be a Palestinian state, and the second nightmare is that there will be. And I think that that's true for very large numbers of Israelis. I find that inner conflict much less true for American Jews. And I wish American Jews were more conflicted, I wish right-wing Jews really faced the consequences of the last 50 years. Mm. And I wish left-wing Jews would just look at the damn map and look at Israel's reality and not judge us so harshly.
Well, I hope that your book can start a conversation or be part of a conversation. It gets both sides out of the cycle of denial. Again, our guest was Yossi Klein Halevi, the author of Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, published by Harper's and available everywhere. Really a important and powerful piece of work. So I hope everyone can get a copy. Thanks for joining us.
Really a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.